With a sideways look at history, including discussions, reviews of alternate history media, and your comments, this is the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
And it's the third of these programmes. Welcome along to this month's edition of the Alternate History Show. And coming up in the next 90 minutes, we've got an early Christmas present, a nice cheerful subject for you. It's all about nuclear war and nuclear weapons. In particular, what would the world look like today without nuclear weapons? What if there had been no or reduced Manhattan Project? What about the war that didn't happen in the late 1940s and the early 50s? What would China look like had a nuclear weapon ended the Civil War? And what would Korea look like had things taken a different, more sinister turn in the early 50s? We'll look at the Cuban Missile Crisis. What would have happened had things escalated to the point where a war occurred? And what if there was no Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962? What if instead there had been a war in the 1970s or maybe the early 1980s? Or perhaps even in the mid to late 1980s as well? Could a nuclear war have happened during the Cold War not involving one or both of the superpowers? And could there have been a nuclear conflict arising after hostilities ceased in the Cold War? We'll be asking all those questions with not one but two guests on the show over the next hour and a half. Plus, coming up, we'll do a couple of 60-second summaries, summarising a piece of classic AH material from the early 2010s, looking at a nuclear war in 1984 and how it affected various places in the world, from Newcastle upon Tyne to New Zealand, and lots more besides as well. We'll be talking about all that when we do the 60-second summary, plus a 1999 novel written, and it received a Sideways Award in that year as well. We'll be looking at Resurrection Day later on in the programme. Plus, in the next hour and a half as well, we are going to be looking at the life and times of Stanislav Petrov, the man who some claim saved the world from nuclear annihilation in 1983. But what's true and what isn't? As well as all that, Alex Wallace will be joining us in about an hour and a bit with the Feedback Hub. We're looking for your comments on the show, not only on this show but the previous couple of shows as well, and we'll be having a look at the latest AH news as well. That's all coming up throughout the show in the next hour and a half.
The Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns. In association with AlternateHistory.com, the world's premier alternate history discussion site.
And joining me, as I was saying, I have two guests on today's programme. First of all, Alex Wallace, a.k.a. Spanish Spy, who you will already know if you've been listening to the past couple of episodes. Hello, Alex.
Hello, Ben. Nice to be here, as always.
It's good to have you with us. And we have a new guest on today's show as well. He was suitably impressed, or at least not too disimpressed, with the previous couple of episodes. He thought he'd join us on the show today as well. It's Colin Salt, a.k.a. Coiler. Hello.
Hello.
How you doing? Where are you calling from, by the way?
New York. Hudson New York. Valley, New York.
Oh, the city that never sleeps, or so they say.
More like the upper edge of the commuter belt of the city that never sleeps.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant stuff. All right, now, I asked Alex this when he came on the show for the first time a couple of months back. Where does the username Coiler come from? Because that's what you're known as on AH.com.
It's actually a bit of a long story.
Right.
Some people think like it's a misspelling or something of Collier, or how you pronounce that, but it's actually not.
Right.
I actually had, when I was a teenager, which shows how weird I am, a weird fascination with the oil industry of all things.
Right.
Because I was bad at spelling, I had my nickname, or my username on one of my favorite forums, was OPEC oiler, OPEC, like the oil cartel.
Ah,
yes.
Right, and yes.
Because that was one word, people started shortening it to coiler. So when I grew up a bit, I thought, okay, I'll just adopt a more mature version. So coiler and coiler stock. And I've been using that for pretty much everything ever since, including my own blogs.
Most teenagers were into sort of music or fashion. You were into oil.
Yes, lovely. Oil drilling.
Lovely, lovely stuff.
I slightly am to the point where I've been looking at sort of the possibility of, which sort of ties back in a little to this episode, Nixon era plans to seize the world's oil field. So I guess that's still there to an extent.
Oh, there you go. And we were just about to come on to the main thrust of the episode, which is, of course, nuclear weapons, nuclear power, nuclear war, nuclear, basically. And yeah, nuclear and Cold War. So let's start, I suppose, at the very beginning of the, well, when nuclear power, the idea of nuclear power came to most people's attention, sort of World War II time and just beforehand, the Manhattan Project. I mean, could that have been prevented in any way, shape or form? What do you think? Because I know me and Alex, we talked about this in quite a lot of detail during the World War II special that we did a couple of months back. So we won't talk about it too much. We will move on fairly swiftly. But just to address it, could that have happened? Could there have been no Manhattan Project or a reduced Manhattan Project? Could there have been more concentration on defeating the Axis powers militarily on the field, so to speak?
So I was reading Daniel Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine, Confessions of a Nuclear War Planner, which, incidentally, is one of the scariest books I've ever read.
Right.
From the second part of the book, which is discussing the history of American nuclear doctrine, he argues that a certain Luftwaffe raid on London during World War II was the big sea change, in that the Germans were aiming for this military facility near London. The bombers went off course, bombed like the city of London, bombed like residential areas.
Yeah.
And so how the RAF retaliated was by sending the bombers against German cities.
Mm.
What Ellsberg argues is that a city in and of itself is a valid military target.
Right.
So when the Americans enter the war in Europe, they continue doing this.
Yeah.
Bombing German cities. Most infamous example is Dresden. You also have Pforzheim and Hamburg. Those are some other famous ones. And they bring this doctrine to Japan, in which, knowing fully well that most Japanese cities at the time were built mostly out of wood, they use firebombs to just set the cities aflame. So it's this transformation of the notion of an acceptable target is what Ellsberg argues brought nuclear weapons and their doctrine to be formulated as they were in our reality.
Yeah, so nuclear war, nuclear weapons, as they were, emerged from this raid, which is interesting because I thought, or at least the narrative goes, the Allied powers focused largely on the Manhattan Project as a way to sort of develop the nuclear bomb because they feared the Axis powers may have the idea of developing such a weapon and they wanted to beat them to it, so to speak.
There was indeed research by the Germans and Japanese for nuclear weapons themselves.
Yes.
However, as you know, they both were, like, the German one was mismanaged a lot, and both of them just had, like the Axis conventional armies, huge shortages of resources. So there wasn't really that much, especially within the time frame of no real chance of them getting a nuclear weapon before the war ended.
Which is interesting, but then I suppose the question is, would the Allies definitely know that? And if
they didn't know that.
No.
It's better to assume the worst. As for if the Manhattan Project could have been stopped,
I like to think of the sort of, well, if you were writing a different story, an actual alternate history story, I'd say the 20 banana peels in a row theorem might at least push it back long enough. Like, there's 100 accidents, a bunch of coincidental accidents all in a row, delay progress on the Manhattan Project to the point where, and this is the big kicker, the U.S. actually has to invade Japan itself.
Yeah.
If we're talking about invading Japan, I'm reminded of Paul Hines' Decisive Darkness duology, and which is set during an American invasion of Japan, and they use a truly tremendous amount of nuclear bombs on Japan. It's like 30 nukes?
Yes. Wow.
And yeah, they're like... it's called Operation Petbie. I had to look up what Petbie was, and he's the Egyptian god of vengeance, which is kind of terrifyingly appropriate. And so it says in the book, later historians would ask if this constitutes genocide. It's like, that's how bad it is.
Basically, the U.S. didn't really get a really genuine nuclear capability until the 1950s. Yes, they had nuclear bombs early in the Cold War, but they were very slapdash. They were still in the post-war demobilization mode, so it was more, their own nuclear deterrent was more theoretical than real early on. And of course, the Soviets were even worse.
Yeah. So things hadn't been developed, basically, you're saying. So I suppose what you could be saying as well, going back to our slightly earlier point, is that that the Manhattan Project, had it been delayed, the banana skin theory as deposited, would have led to perhaps quite easily less nuclear power and possible sort of reduction in nuclear power or elimination. The idea wouldn't have moved forward after the Second World War, maybe.
No, I think it definitely would have moved forward. It would have moved forward more slowly, but it would have moved, because who would say no to something that big?
Yeah. I mean, there is the idea as well that no or reduced nuclear power of both superpowers would have led to a third world war at some point. What would you say
Well, you see, the weird part about me, because of my background, is that I've actually been reading lots of things, and my big sort of focus thing is what I've had way too much experience with, what I started a whole blog about, is of a Soviet-American World War III that doesn't use nuclear weapons. So that's kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah, I was going to say, the idea on both sides, the prevailing idea, was that a Third World War would be nuclear.
Yes, and I think that was a very good, solid, wonderful idea, because it's very important to have that, which has contributed to peace, that if you start a third world war, it would go nuclear and it would be unwinnable. Yeah. So I think it's a very good thing for the world that the conventional World War III idea has been niche, but still extant. And I can even tell you, if you want, about how that sort of developed.
If we're talking about a mostly conventional World War III between the former Western Allies and the Eastern Bloc, I think the most plausible possibility for that, that doesn't end with just everybody dies, is Korea.
Yes.
There were a couple of scares during Korea that led to that. And I think that the two big things that make that more plausible, and it's not just everyone dies, is that you didn't have ICBMs, you didn't have those until around 1960, and you didn't have the H-bomb.
Yeah.
When, in like the early 50s, when you still have to use bombers to deliver mostly Hiroshima-esque size weapons, I think Harry Turtledove's Hot War trilogy does a decent job of showing there's like a lot of bombs going off, but it's not the end of the species.
Yeah.
Yes, that's probably the best case. Yeah, Korea, it's very much the sweet spot for it, if you can call anything related to nuclear war sweet, yeah. Of course.
Least worst time for it, I suppose.
Yeah, because basically by the early 60s, Cuban Missile Crisis, several things have happened. One, yes, you get ICBMs. Granted, the Soviets didn't have that many by the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, but you get the idea.
Yeah.
And second, everyone is basically, both sides are basically at their most definite nuclear, there will be a nuclear war, it will be nuclear. So, you know, the Pentomic divisions?
Yes, yeah.
The Pentomic divisions, you have this sort of focus on a nuclear war. So you have the Pentomics. I've actually read the field manuals for the Pentomic divisions, and the amount of space they give to non-nuclear operations is basically like a few sentences just in a 100-page thing. Yeah. And similar, like captured, translated, declassified Soviet ones of the time period, also very similar, around 1960-ish, very, very, very nuclear focused.
Yes, yeah.
And then, of course, nuclear weapons getting more and more and more and more powerful, more and more common, more and more used. And a good reason for a lot of that is simply just pork barrel industries. Like if you're in a rocket plant, you generally want more rockets. And what better way to get rockets than nuclear missiles? So, but then, in the actual conventional side of things, starting in the mid-late 60s, you get, and again on both sides, like more talk of at least what was called in a lot of documents a conventional phase, which is to say, if there's a big war, yes, it'll probably almost certainly end with nuclear weapons, but it might not start with them, so you need to be prepared to fight like that anyway. Yeah. And then this sort of just a tiny bit gets a little more sort of a little more up and up, like maybe a little more to conventional, a little more to conventional. And then by this point, the Soviet Union collapses.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, very interesting.
Goes. But yeah, starting in the late 60s through the 70s and 80s, you get a more genuine attention given to conventional operations.
I have a little point of divergence I think might make this a little more interesting in that I was reading Neil Sheehan's work about Bernard Shriver, the father of the American ICBM program. Mm. So what it describes for a good portion of the late 50s, there's this back and forth argument between Bernard Shriver on the one hand and Curtis LeMay on the other.
Oh yes.
Curtis LeMay.
The shy and retiring Curtis LeMay.
He was an Air Force general, well, before then Army Air Corps. He was the mastermind of the firebombing of Japan.
Mm.
That's what made him prominent.
Yeah.
And so late, like into the 50s and 60s, he's a big name in the Air Force. And when he's confronted with Shriver's proposals for ICBMs, he is initially very skeptical and wants to focus mostly on the bomber force, because partially because ICBMs weren't proved, partially because, and Sheehan implies that it's rather cynical of him to preserve his own power as like the head of the bomber wing. Mm. So if LeMay wins over Shriver in this timeline, maybe. Yeah. Like the period of not of a, everybody dies is pushed back to like the late 60s rather than like the late like the early 60s.
Yeah.
And you can get the possibility of a more conventional, relatively speaking, war than you got in reality.
Mm.
I would disagree with that. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry, I would disagree because I think that what ICBMs did was just make things more efficient. Like, you don't have to, like here with ICBMs, you can, and this is still oversimplifying, just push the button. You don't have to have a dozen bombers and all their tankers and such always hovering just outside the Soviet border, the airborne alerts. And by this point, though, the Americans still had lots and lots and lots of bombers by 1960. And so I think by that point, the door had been opened. And that's the first thing. The second thing is that theater nuclear weapons by this point, like Scuds for the Soviets with nuclear warheads, the like corporal rup sergeant rank missiles for the US, those sort of things, those were also in force. So by that point, at least Europe would have been nuclear toast because like I said before, they were expecting nukes to be used from day one. So I would disagree slightly on that.
Well, I think you're probably right. I do think it's worth mentioning, though, that I think that most of LeMay's opposition was like in the 50s, because I know by the Kibble missing crisis he had been converted to an ICBMs.
Yeah,
and he was totally in favor of a military response against the Russians and Cuba. So I think by the Cuban Missile Crisis, yeah, it'll go pretty much as you say it will.
If we move on to the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962, October of that year, if that goes hot, Europe will get the brunt, I suppose.
Yeah, that's basically the last point in time when the U.S. can come out and truly say that it won. It'll still get hammered. Don't worry. No questions asked. But by this, but the Soviet arsenal just isn't big enough at this point. Mm. But in a few years, it will be for true mutual destruction.
Who would be most damaged in a 1962 nuclear war? Well, I guess the Soviets on the whole.
Yeah,
but
Soviets get wiped out. I think they do have the capacity to reach the American mainland. They just don't have the ability to really get it going the way that they would have even in just a few years. So
yeah,
if we're talking Cuban Missile Crisis goes hot, I'd like to point you to a Brendan Dubois fascinating book, Resurrection Day, about that very subject,
which we will be talking about on the 60-second summary, actually. So that's all good. I mean, do talk about what you think about it.
I think that it's a pretty good depiction in broad strokes of what a 1962 war would look like, in that the Eastern Bloc just ceases to exist in any meaningful sense.
Right.
Also, I would point out at this time, going from Ellsberg's book, American nuclear doctrine was to always treat the Soviet Union and China as being inextricably on the same side.
Yeah.
So the Soviets do something, the Chinese are dead, and vice versa. As relations go on, that changes, and that's one of the things that Ellsberg stresses in his book, that's kind of insane and omnicidal, but nobody changed it until it was too late and it became irrelevant.
Mm.
But in terms of Resurrection Day, you have Eastern Bloc ceases to exist, several American cities are blown up, but like not all of them, so, like America still exists, to put it bluntly.
Yeah.
Western Europe, a lot of Western Europe still there.
That seems to be one of the sticking points with Resurrection Day. A lot of people have the main gripe a lot of people have with it.
Yeah, I can see that.
Mm.
Yeah, I would expect Paris and London at least to be new, plus a couple of American bases.
Mm. So are you stipulating that perhaps after a Cuban Missile War, the US is perhaps still a world power mainly because all the other countries would be hit as well?
Yes.
I mean, probably, yeah. Between the US, the Soviet Union, China, and some conglomeration of Western European states, the US is going to come out the best. It's still not going to come out good, but totally because everyone else has ceased to exist.
You're listening to this month's Alternate History Show of myself, Ben Kearns, joined by two very special guests in the shape of Colin Salt and Alex Wallace. Much more from those guys in part two of this month's programme, when we'll discuss more on the Cuban Missile Crisis, albeit the opposite extreme to what you've just heard. We've just been talking about the idea of it going nuclear, but what if there had been no Cuban Missile Crisis whatsoever? What if it had been delayed? How could a world war have developed involving nuclear weapons in the 1970s? Could a conflict have arisen involving nuclear weapons, but not involving one or both of the main superpowers at the time? We'll discuss all that and more in the next half hour, in approximately 5 minutes' time, or pretty much whenever you want part two of this month's show. Going to take a temporary break from proceedings in the meantime, so I can do this.
The Alternate History Show presents the 60-second summary.
Now, if you've just listened to episode 3 and haven't caught up with episode 1 and 2, here's what happens on this segment of the programme. Basically, I take a couple of pieces of alternate history literature. It can be a book, it can be a film on alternate history, or it might be a timeline that has been written on one of the many alternate history websites across the internet, as long as it involves alternate history. And I give you 60 seconds worth of information about that particular publication, basically so I can whet your appetite but not give too much away, so you still want to check it out for yourself. And we'll be having a look at an alternate history timeline published on alternatehistory.com back in 2010, in a little while, involving the idea of a 1984 nuclear war scenario, how it unfolded, how the run-up occurred, and what happened afterwards. You'll hear more on that later, or more on a little bit of it at the very least. Right now, it is an alternate history book which received a Sideways Award, the Sideways Award, back in 1999. It is Resurrection Day. But what's it all about? Well, here goes. Resurrection Day was set in 1972, a decade after the Cuban Missile Crisis in this timeline escalated to the point of a nuclear conflict. The USA was badly hit, but the USSR was pretty much wiped off the face of the earth, with Western Europe mainly escaping intact. In particular, the British Empire managed to make a bit of a comeback and recolonialize due to the effects of the war. The story is set in 1972 and features a journalist in the US contacting a UK journalist to try and work out what exactly happened in the run-up to the war and who was to blame for the conflict. Was it President Kennedy, as is the narrative in this timeline, or does the blame belong to General Curtis LeMay, who is widely regarded as a hero who saved his nation? That's the concept of the book, and I've run out of time, so I will not talk anymore. Right, part two of the podcast is coming up. In part two, we'll be talking about more nuclear scenarios. Almost Infamous features the man who some claim saved us from World War III in 1983, and we'll summarise Protect and Survive in the next half hour. I'm not talking about the British manual that was published in the early 80s, the booklet, or in fact the voiceovers by Patrick Allen, which were published as part of the Protect and Survive manual. I am instead talking about the Protect and Survive inspired timeline of the same name on alternatehistory.com. I won't say too much, but Portsmouth is the capital of the UK. All that more when we return in part two, coming up.
It's history with a twist. You're listening to the Alternate History Show with Ben Kearns.
One other idea I've been interested in is something that perhaps doesn't get explored that often, the idea of no Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. So let's say either JFK or Khrushchev or anyone else is not in the position that they are in what we would call OTL, so our timeline, and it just doesn't happen for whatever reason. Do we need a change at the Kremlin or in the White House to sort of prevent the Cuban Missile Crisis? And if it doesn't happen, what are the effects?
In order to prevent a Cuban Missile Crisis, you kind of need to prevent the whole post-World War II settlement between Washington and Moscow. And
right.
That you have Stalin going against the agreements of Tehran and Yalta by, like, establishing puppet states in Eastern Europe, and that persuades the Western powers that the Soviet Union is like Nazi Germany in that it is cavalierly invading places and therefore needs to be contained at all costs. I mean, the books I read argue that the Soviet Union wasn't as expansion happy as the Nazis were, that they wanted that cordon sanitaire in Eastern Europe and in Central Asia, but were mostly willing to stay there. Well, like, not, but like, they'd fund resistance movements elsewhere, but they wouldn't, like, invade the places usually. Well, Afghanistan's an interesting thing because it's on the border.
The obvious way to prevent the Cuban Missile Crisis is to obviously not have Castro come into power in the first place.
Yes.
Either he doesn't come into power, or the U.S. doesn't bother with the Bay of Pigs and just invades immediately in force and tosses him out then. So that's the one thing, but it's either that, and that has huge geopolitics on its own, but it's either that, or what you're thinking of is, do they not make a big deal about the missiles? Like, if they just lodge the obligatory complaint, but just otherwise let the missiles stay there, would that be considered averting it?
I guess so. It would avert the crisis, I suppose. But how realistic would that second option be?
I don't think it terribly is, because Americans aren't used to having the specter of invasion or annihilation right next to them.
Yeah.
Whereas Western Europe,
I think it was probably inevitable when that happened.
You need to prevent that notion in Washington that the Soviet Union is aggressively expansive and wants to, like, invade everywhere.
Mm.
Because what this leads to is the American missile base in Turkey, which terrified the Soviets, which led them to put missiles in Cuba.
Yeah.
What you need is to prevent the Turkish missile base. And if, as long as Washington is afraid of Moscow, which scared the West by, like, reneging on its World War II commitments in Eastern Europe, if you can stop all that, you won't have a Turkish missile base. If that goes on, you'll have a Turkish missile base.
Yeah.
And the Soviet Union, that means you'll have missiles hit Moscow, Leningrad, everything in the Russian heartland.
Mm.
And so that's, in terms of, like, the broad geopolitics, that's what you need to change to stop the Cuban Missile Crisis.
If it gets delayed a little, it soon becomes less relevant. Like, the missiles in Cuba amount to basically what can be carried in a single Soviet ballistic missile submarine that launches as little as a few years later. So I think that if it does get delayed, it might become less relevant. But I would argue that something like it is pretty much inevitable as long as the Cold War, as we know it, happens.
Right. And when are you saying it's inevitable by?
Pretty much by any real point, like, definitely before 1970.
Yeah.
Of course, then you have Vietnam and you have China detonating its own first nuclear bomb in 1964, which is another part of the puzzle.
Yes. Okay, so it's an interesting geopolitical environment in 1962. So are you saying it's probably going to happen at least by 1970 or before 19 or by 1964 at the absolute latest?
1970 at the absolute latest, but pretty much any time in the 60s.
If it doesn't happen in 1962, does that mean Khrushchev gets a stay of political execution at the very least?
I don't know enough about Soviet internal politics to make a real firm judgment on that.
Mm.
Khrushchev was a swashbuckler from what I've heard of him. So I think something else might have happened, which is another reason why I think there might have been a crisis like this at some point, especially if Khrushchev was still in power. But yeah, I don't know of the internal power structure of the Soviets enough to really make a firm claim on that.
I mean, assuming this is delayed until the mid-60s, let's say, and assuming butterflies, I guess this could be interesting because we could speculate on whether the assassination of Kennedy would have happened in 1963 in this situation. But how would Johnson have dealt with it, let's say?
Well, Johnson, this is the big problem with pretty much any alternate history, because as we know in real life, Johnson would be undoubtedly influenced by the experience of the Cuban Missile Crisis. That if he didn't experience that, or if Nixon had been president, or if Kennedy had either lost or had to quietly retire for health reasons in 1964 and someone else came in, whoever that, if they didn't have something as big as this, we don't really know for sure how they would have reacted. Johnson was pretty timid in the early phases of Vietnam in all the worst ways, but he... But how he would have handled apart from that, I do not know.
That takes us, I suppose, onto the Vietnam, the time of the Vietnam War in the mid-60s. And there was speculation, was there not, that a nuclear warhead could have been used during the war in Vietnam? It was decided against, of course, by Washington. I mean, had that happened in the mid-60s, I guess, I mean, would that have definitely escalated things, and would that have brought the Soviets in?
I mean, if they use it, I think at the very least the Chinese enter.
Yes.
I would not be surprised that the Soviets decide to enter if the Americans use a nuke. I think it's unlikely the Americans use that nuke for that very reason.
Well, define what you mean by enter, because as you know, there were a lot of like Soviet and Chinese like missile instructors, technicians, gunners, like supply people there. But if you're talking like Chinese actual ground formations, which after Korea, the Americans were incredibly concerned with, that's something else. Would it have gotten them involved if there's a nuke? I'm not sure, because by this point in the early 60s, China's nuclear arsenal is at like 1940s Soviet level. So yeah. I don't know if there's any direct capability, but I haven't really seen that it was that serious of plans to use nukes in Vietnam, for the weird reason that I've read in Marshall McKell's The 11 Days of Christmas, which is about the 1972 bombings of Vietnam, that
yes,
for most of the war, the Americans thought they were winning and that there was no need to escalate that way. So that would suggest that they would not have nuclear weapons in that case then.
And it was something, I say, I think it was fleetingly discussed at least, but you don't think it would have to get pretty desperate for it to be considered. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, like I'm talking like China invades in force and there's 500,000 Chinese marching on the Mekong Delta. That kind of like absolute desperate conventional overrun thing, but I haven't, not in the circumstance of the war as it was actually fought, I don't think.
So we move on to the detente era, I suppose, if you call it that, sort of late 60s to late 70s. And a lot of the ideas of nuclear war scenarios arise either during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Some, of course, go back to sort of early to mid 50s with Korea and China and that kind of stuff. And some would focus on sort of the Abel Archer time period. I mean, could there have been a nuclear war? Were there opportunities and sort of pitfalls between the time, between those times, however, sort of late 60s to late 70s?
Oh, yeah, definitely the Yom Kippur War was a huge superpower flashpoint in 1973.
Yes,
gigantic.
Yes, yeah.
You have a sort of backing off that's only – that's basically because of the Vietnam War, everything has been backing off. There isn't as much direct confrontation in the decade after Vietnam. But if by some other alternate chance there was, you could definitely see a nuclear scare there. And then, of course, there's what actually inspired the movie War Games. I don't know if you've read about this, Alex. Someone put a simulation tape in the wrong spot, and there was a brief nuclear war scare in the late 70s, that incident. So I'm not saying something like that couldn't have happened elsewhere in the wrong time and place.
Honestly, I think anytime after the Cuban Missile Crisis, the topic of a nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, the answer is everybody dies. And frankly, there's not much discussion there.
Yeah.
If you want a nuclear war in which not everybody dies after the Cuban Missile Crisis, you want to look elsewhere. Yom Kippur War, as Colin was saying, also the Sino-Indian border clash in 1962.
Yes.
That's one. Mm. Israeli War in Lebanon, another one. And those... It's like those little things where one of the great powers could have been drawn into, I think, is the most likely for a situation where not everybody dies.
Yeah. I mean, take Yom Kippur, for example, however, the thing I would have with this, with the idea of a 1973 war, is at some point before it becomes nuclear. I mean, I've heard it said that Israel would have used perhaps a nuclear weapon had things have got to the point where, Syria would have invaded, and if they were in danger of invasion, then a nuclear weapon would have been used. My point is, the reason why I think that's perhaps difficult or maybe impossible is Nixon and Brezhnev at that point were, well, whatever else they were, despite their many flaws, they were both fairly foreign policy minded, and Nixon especially, of course, is going to get come under domestic pressure at this point due to Watergate and due to Agnew resigning and all that jazz, basically. And I suppose, despite his outbursts, there's very little scope for cooler heads not to prevail. But you're saying
I would agree.
Yeah. But it's still possible.
It's unlikely, but still cannot be ruled out entirely in the 70s, that point you're talking about.
If that happens, if the Israelis do use a nuclear weapon, I mean, what are the superpowers' responses? What happens after that?
I have to give a disappointing answer and say I don't really know. My gut says I don't see the Soviets immediately launching, but another part of me says it can't be ruled out.
Yeah, I can see at that point potential very high scale, very panicky perhaps, negotiations starting between the two superpowers at that point, had something of that ilk occurred, or even had it been likely, had it even been threatened by the Israelis, I suspect there would be some sort of very high scale diplomatic negotiation, and Kissinger would be earning his pay at the very least in this situation, I'd imagine.
Maybe he could get a Nobel Prize he actually deserved.
There you go.
I would still be alive.
Okay, very, very interesting stuff. So that'll be 1973, I guess, yeah. And you did bring up the idea of the Russia Sino.
1969.
The Cold War, I suppose the mini Cold War they have going hot.
The incident I wrote about was actually 1962 over that part of southern Tibet that India claims. I was reading this big book about India-Pakistan relations from like early 20th century to the late 2000s, and it said that the Americans were considering using nukes. The thing is, this was the same few days as the Cuban Missile Crisis, so
yes.
that could lead to apocalypse also.
Well, I honestly think, though, that it was spared because of the Cuban Missile Crisis, that the Sino-Indian border war, the U.S. didn't make as big a deal of it as it could have been. So it's actually fortunate in a twisted way that the Cuban Missile Crisis was at the same time. Mm. And you mentioned, like, because there have been two conventional wars fought between countries that both had nuclear weapons.
Yes.
There has been the Sino-Soviet border war in like the late 60s and the cargo war between India and Pakistan in, I believe, 1999.
I think it was 1994. Is that right?
No, I think it's late 90s at least.
Yes. Okay, well, we'll come on to
around that. And what you can see from both of those is that, one, in both cases, it came terrifyingly close to nuclear war. But the other thing you can see about these conventional wars is that the stakes were very low. Like, it's a few isolated spots in a very low populated border. The stakes are low in that circumstance. And what, now going back to my personal hobby / quote unquote expertise, is that that isn't the case in what I've called, and even named my blog, the fold apocalypse, fold a gap apocalypse, where if the Soviets are pouring into Western Germany in mass or wherever they go, and there's this sense of overrun back to the wall, in that case, the stakes are very, very high. And that's why I don't see the losing side not pushing the button.
Would there be restraint? Because if obviously one person pushes the button, then someone else is going to as well, and everyone loses at that point.
Well, I can't say for sure, but I know that, and I've heard that if nuclear weapons make a big war less likely, they make smaller wars, either proxy wars like in the Cold War, or this sort of semi-subversive clash, somewhat more likely because of that kind of, because that sort of, if you know they're not going to nuke you over a tiny spot of the border, then you can do that sort of thing without, and knowing that it won't trigger a bigger war.
Okay, I get where you
definitely see that. I read a book called The Cold War's Killing Fields by Paul Thomas Chamberlain about a year ago, and he was arguing that, and he argued that that nuclear brinkmanship led to a lot of wars in Asia getting a lot worse than they would have otherwise, because it gave incentive to one power or the other to aid a faction in this war, which intensified it, which ended up killing more people. So he argues that the notion of the Cold War as a long peace is Eurocentric at best.
This is the Alternate History Show. Ben with you for another 35 minutes with the guys. More from Colin Salt and Alex Wallace in part three as we talk about nuclear war in the 80s and possibly after 1991. What could have happened to spark a conflict after 1991? Much more on all that and more besides coming up. Right now, we got a couple of other little bits and pieces to do. The small matter now of Almost Infamous for you. And as promised, it's about the man who many credit as having saved us from World War III. Stanislav Petrov is his name. He was born on, interestingly enough, September the 7th of 1939, 6 days after the official start of the Second World War. His father was actually a pilot in the army. Petrov himself would later go on to study military studies and would end up helping to develop the early warning nuclear system for the Soviets. His brush with infamy came in 1983, in September of that year, when he was monitoring the early warning signals when he saw five igniting at the same time, which seemed to suggest that five nuclear weapons were coming from the US to Russia. Petrov, thinking that this was probably an erroneous report, but nevertheless being concerned, did not report it to his superiors, which has led many people to suggest that he alone prevented World War III, or at least contributed a great part to preventing World War III. And other less cautious officers may have reported it upwards, which could have led to a retaliatory attack by the Soviets towards the USA, which would have caused a third world war. Petrov himself, though, is slightly more reserved about, or he was slightly more reserved about his brush with infamy, saying, "I didn't even tell my wife for 10 years. In fact, his role in this incident only arose and only reached the public perception in 1998. Since then, though, there has been growing interest in Petrov. In 2006, he went to address the UN and receive an award. He even met legendary American journalist Walter Cronkite back in 2006 as well. And in 2013, he was awarded a Peace Prize, not the Nobel Peace Prize, but he was awarded a Peace Prize in Germany and was also given 25,000 euros for his trouble. He was not officially awarded or disciplined massively by the Soviet government, although they did discipline him for his note-taking of the event. He did retire from the army in 1984, although he was careful to say that he was not pushed out by the Soviet government. He did retire, however, and he worked more on the early warning system for the USSR until it disbanded in 1991, of course. He retired relatively early on. He unfortunately lost his wife to cancer in 1997 and passed away 20 years later himself in 2017. However, he died in May, but his death was not widely reported until September, when a journalist who was friends with him tried to contact him, and he was told by Petrov's son Dmitry, who survived him, of course, that he had passed away. Petrov was also survived by a daughter, Yelena, as well. So there you go. The life and times of Stanislav Petrov. Moving on now to a 60-second summary.
The Alternate History Show presents the 60-second summary.
And it's a similar but not identical time, actually, we're looking at now. We are looking at an alternate history depicting a nuclear war in 1984. It is the Protect and Survive timeline. I'm going to tell you much more about that starting now. Protect and Survive was based off the eponymous documents published in the early 1980s, alerting people to the dangers of nuclear conflict. It was set in 1984. The nuclear attacks struck on February the 21st of that year, after 4 months of building national tension. The timeline mainly concentrates on Britain after the nuclear war, and in particular Newcastle and the effects of the nuclear strike and what people did after the nuclear conflict to survive. However, there was also some information regarding the rest of the world. We have quite a few spin-offs, actually, of the timeline. An unusual amount of spin-offs for an alternate history on alternatehistory.com, evidently. Focusing on the US, Australia, and New Zealand, and even Switzerland as well. Very, very interesting timeline. Well worth a read if you haven't done so already. This is the Alternate History Show with me, Ben Kearns. We're back in a couple of minutes' time, or at any rate, we're back soon with part three, whenever you fancy listening to it. And in part three, more discussions between me, Alex, and Colin regarding nuclear war and nuclear scenarios from the 1980s onwards this time around. And we'll have all the latest alternate history news in the feedback hub, including news on Turtle Dove's latest novel. That's all to come.
This is the Alternate History Show. We revisit the past, change it, and see what happens. Enough said.
Let's move on to the early 80s then. And, I mean, things develop apace. I mean, could the... Focusing sort of on the Cold War at the moment, could the detente era in politics, in interpolitics, could it have continued? Because, of course, you had Reagan and then Andropov and all those guys coming to the fore in the early 80s. I mean, could things have sort of drifted along in a fairly cordial way into the early, well into the early 80s?
I'm not sure. I think sooner or later something would have happened.
Yeah.
Regardless of who was in office or who was in power. This is going back to the great man versus determinism thing, but
I think something
would have happened.
And do you put that down? I mean, would that be post the invasion? Would that definitely be post the invasion of Afghanistan? And definitely after that, things were going. I mean, even during the end of Carter's term in office, things were starting to develop in that direction at that point anyway. But then had that not happened, I mean, is there any way that the invasion of Afghanistan could have been prevented at that stage?
I don't know. It's the kind of thing where I don't know if it could have even been prevented or if something else wouldn't have happened in its place. Mm. I think with a lot of things, it's just at some point and sometimes something might be inevitable.
Sure. So, it would have happened regardless at some point.
Either that or something that would reignite the Cold War would have happened at some point, even if it wasn't necessarily there.
Yeah, a leader in the Kremlin or in the US or somewhere else would have come to the fore. And, they would have had a different stance on things than the previous, more detente minded of those. On the top table of both countries, I suppose, towards the mid 80s. All right, let's move on because we're going to talk now about a guy who I have been mentioning in the almost infamous segment of the show, a guy called Stanislav Petrov, born in 1939, of course. Now, I love a romantic hero as much as the next guy, don't get me wrong, but, you know, tellingly, he didn't even admit to saving the world, as a lot of people have speculated that he did do. I mean, did Stanislav Petrov, by keeping a cool head when he saw supposedly a nuclear strike upon Russian soil, five nuclear strikes, should I say, did he prevent, on his own, a third world war and global thermonuclear annihilation? Or is it more complicated than that? Was he being modest or was he being truthful when he said that he didn't save the world?
I mean, understanding is that by that point, both the US and the Soviet Union had doctrines of massive retaliation with their nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
So what happened with Petrov is that the computer is saying there was like one or two missiles heading for the Soviet Union, which is what cued him off. It was fake, because had there been a real attack, there would have been thousands of warheads.
Mm.
I mean, there was a similar thing with Abel Archer, where it was an American officer, I think his name was Leonidas Peril, something like that, which basically...
Sounds quite Russian, actually. But you were saying?
So... I think that any sane person with a knowledge of the nuclear doctrine would have recognized what Petrov saw as fake.
Yeah.
But if you have someone who is incompetent and doesn't get that, everyone dies.
Well, I think that what I think would have realistically happened is that If Petrov sees the alert and doesn't see the alert and stop, then his supervisor would have seen the alert. Then he would have gone, okay, there's no way they would have only launched a few. So it's a fake. So we're calling it off. And that person would get credit as the man who saved the world. So I think Petrov was being truthful. And he was also being modest at the same time. I think those aren't incompatible.
Okay. So basically, if it hadn't been him, it would have been someone else. Perhaps even if it had gone to the head honchos at the Kremlin, then it would have even been them at some point. And I mean, is there any chance that a nuclear war could have developed at that point?
I mean, I think you need to have just the wrong combination of people at that one base in Serpukhov.
Yeah.
That's, like, what you need. If you don't... at least if there's, like, one person who isn't, like, suicidal...
Yeah.
You're good.
Yeah.
Well, there's the... there's also an interesting thing about the Soviets reportedly building a... beefing up their response systems to deter not the Americans, but their own civilian leadership.
Ah, right, yeah. So giving them just enough to know what exactly would happen in that scenario, but trying to prevent...
The explanation is that there's no need to be paranoid about we'll fall for a first strike, therefore we'll be on edge. If you think you have the capability to retaliate, so you're not as on edge, you're just basically trust the launch order system, trust the submarines, etc., and that's sort of like a defense mechanism in and of itself. It's what I've heard, okay. At least.
All right. Well, let's move on to Able Archer, which will, of course, the NATO exercise, which was around about the same time, actually, as well. I mean, why a lot of people say that was a lot more dangerous than the Petrov incident. Why exactly? Because it's not something that I know a tremendous amount about, that particular event, or the series of events that happened around about November 1983.
So I read a book about Able Archer, and... Okay, I might be... Hopefully I'm not getting this wrong. Colin, if I get anything wrong, correct me, please. That there was this Soviet automated weapon system that was... That sounds a lot like the War Games movie, in that it was programmed that if there's a... If there's a perceived strike, it'll fire everything.
And really what it does, from at least from what we've heard of it, obviously, is just transmits launch orders to, like, silos and stuff all around the length of the USSR, Russia. That's the sort of thing I was talking about, that the theory that it was made not so much to deter the Americans so much as reassure their own leadership that they didn't have to be constantly on edge.
Okay, fascinating.
Okay. Yep. I mischaracterized Ryan. It was a intelligence operation by the Soviet Union.
So it's an operation and not a physical thing. Okay.
Mm. Oh, yeah, Ryan is like a way of pronouncing the Russian abbreviation. It's like KGB.
Yes.
So that was a thing they mentioned a lot in that book about Able Archer that I read. And they also mentioned the dead hand thing you had, which is allegedly still operational by the Russians, but they deny that. But I don't really know.
It's kind of dead hand / perimeter is kind of like Israel's nuclear weapons, in that they officially deny it, but everyone knows they exist. And they aren't really caring that much about it. So yeah, the sort of like winking denial is what that sort of perimeter dead hand system is.
Let's move to near to the end of the Cold War. At what point, in your opinion, was a nuclear war possible? At what point could the Cold War have gone hot? When was the last point in history that could have happened before the end of the official end of the Cold War?
Okay, so so before December 1991, I'm using that instead of the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Yeah, yeah.
It's arbitrary nitpicking, of course, but before 1991, I honestly think that the best time is in the Korean 50s period, because nuclear weapons are because one is powerful, less effective, so there's still a chance of it being limited, if not an intent, at least an execution, like Alex said. Mm-hmm. And two, it's where the Soviets are the most desperate and therefore the most reckless, if that's the right word, or at least more because of that big disadvantage. My period, it drops a lot after the Cuban Missile Crisis, after the arsenals get big enough and safe enough for true mutually assured destruction, and by this point you kind of have to hand wave, as a lot of writers have done, where having a third world war start is, that's conventional or even nuclear start, is more of a hand wave for me.
Okay.
After the early mid 50s, and especially after the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Well, it's very interesting you say, like, Alex, would you agree with that?
In terms of most likely nuclear war, yeah, Korean War.
Mm.
Because it isn't the existential threat that it is later.
I've heard it said, though, that the end of the Cold War, towards the end, and a lot of people feared, or some people at least feared, that Russia could have launched some sort of nuclear strike, thinking the USSR is going to disband, then everyone is going to disband along with them. I mean, how realistic or otherwise was that?
Look, if the August coup plotters, the people who were trying to restore the USSR, couldn't even fire on protesters in Moscow, they're definitely not going to launch a first strike against the US. That is totally out of the question.
That's the whole issue with that coup, is that they didn't have much loyalty in the armed forces, so they're not going to listen to, like, destroy everything.
All right, well, we're coming towards the end of this end of the show now, but I want to ask, was a nuclear conflict possible after 1991, and if so, when? I think you did mention the Indo-Pakistani war that arose in the 90s.
Okay.
I mean, when were the other times?
Of that book I read on India and Pakistan for this, my impression is that there were two big flare-ups. One was 1999 with the Pakistani invasion of Kashmir.
Yes.
Second was after 9/11, when a group backed by the Pakistani government launched a terrorist attack on the Indian parliament. Those were the two incidents, so was my impression, that nukes could start flying between the two.
Right,
yes. Yes, I would argue that or a similar incident. So there's that. There's India-Pakistan, what Alex mentioned. The obvious second one, although that's kind of implausible, and I could spend an entire episode length complaining about that, is a second Korean War after the North gets nuclear weapons of its own, as we know. And then the third thing is Russia itself, which at this point, especially from like the 90s, especially during the 90s, pretty much had nuclear weapons as its sole effective military system left at that point.
Yeah. But then I guess they were more, the whole point in having them was more so not that they would be used, but as a deterrent, potentially.
Yes.
Like that one South African nuclear program that existed for a while. The point wasn't to, like, use it in war. It was created by the apartheid government to prevent a international intervention in South Africa regarding the white minority treatment of the black majority. In terms of, like, post-Soviet Russia, the one possibility I've seen was in Zhirinovsky's Russian Empire by D.F. Pellegrino.
I've read that.
That's one of the timelines I've been meaning to read, but I haven't got around to it.
Nuclear scare over Kosovo.
Right.
But it doesn't end up happening because they know everyone would die.
Which is, I guess, the crux of any nuclear scenarios, basically, or at least the majority of them.
Yes.
Eventually, cooler heads are going to prevail. It's just a case of when and can they prevail before we get into mad.
This is the Feedback Hub.
It's that time now where we look at the month in news regarding alternate history, and Alex remains with me at the moment. Hello again.
Hello again.
How you doing? It was an interesting, very interesting conversation. And any more news from your neck of the woods regarding alternate history and regarding the alternate timelines? Last time we spoke, you had embarked on quite the refurbishment of the website.
I mean, I think a lot of the stuff for alternate timelines has been done.
Yeah.
I think it looks a lot better than it did a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
It's just a much more streamlined site now, much better organized. Alternate History Online is still Alternate History Online, just good standard discussions there. What I wanted to bring up in this feedback hub are a couple of things that aren't strictly AH, but are interesting to AH people.
Yes.
And a couple of AH films I watched in the past few days that I don't think are too well known.
Mm.
So, first things first, Harry Turtledove's recent novel, Alpha and Omega, which is about a present-day biblical apocalypse, kinda. I'm not going to show you what that means, but I read it, and I, for one, thought this is one of Turtledove's best in a while.
Wow.
I thought it was better than Through Darkest Europe, better than the Hot War Trilogy.
Mm.
And like Alpha and Omega is like Turtledove at his best. It's that the grand scale and that degree of humor he likes throwing in sometimes, and a lot of dramatic irony, a lot of bad people getting their comeuppance. And I reviewed the book for the Washington Science Fiction Association, which I've been in the process of joining.
Very nice.
That review hasn't been published yet, but it will be at some point, and I'll do what I can to publicize that. So I fully recommend Alpha and Omega.
Hmm. Okay, which is interesting because I have actually read Through Darkest Europe for a future project that we're doing on this show in a couple of months' time, which is, it was interesting, but, you know, as you say, perhaps not one of his, perhaps not up there with some of his best work, but you say that this is even better and this is really a Turtledove back on full form.
Yeah, I would say Alpha and Omega is Turtledove at his best, on the level of The Case of Talks Belt Dump, or In the Presence of Mine Enemies, or The Man of the Iron Heart, which is like some of my favorites of his. Reading Through Darkest Europe, I thought it was decent, but the thing going through my mind was Kim Stanley Robinson did this a lot better.
Yeah, I can kind of see where you're going with it. It did seem to be a bit too sort of contrived to be, you know, completely a sort of 180 degree flip of the world, basically, didn't it?
Yeah.
What else have you been up to?
Another thing I'd like to bring to your attention is the World War III Christmas stories called Sergeant Frosty by David Flynn.
Rather appropriately named.
And it originated that Mr. Flynn, a big aficionado of World War III thrillers, writing stories for his children that he, like, literally bedtime stories. And you get silly things like festive ballistic missiles, which like when they explode, they like send out presents everywhere.
And
it's completely silly but incredibly like charming. And like during the holiday season, if like anyone want to read that, I strongly recommend it. It's wonderful.
Very, very interesting. Sort of reminds me of a song that you were talking about off air a couple of weeks back, which, of course, is you can tell us all about it, actually.
Christmas at Ground Zero?
Yes.
Oh, I love that song. I was trying to get Ben to use it as background music for this show, but he said that the legal issues prevented him from doing that, which I get.
Yeah.
But it would have been funny.
It would have been funny. It would have been amusing. Needless to say, I do something else as well. I do a radio gig, or a few radio gigs, and I will be playing it on one of my shows in the next week or so.
Thank you so much, Ben. Thank you so much.
It did make me laugh, I have to say, as pretty much all of Weird Al's songs do. So there you go.
Yeah.
All right. Very interesting stuff. And any more news from your neck of the woods?
Some films I want to bring to the attention of the community.
Yes.
So I watched three over the weekend. First one is this Japanese anime film called Jinro the Wolf Brigade.
Right.
Which is a good story. It is set in an old history, although it's pretty in the background.
Yeah.
Of my understanding, it's a different World War II where Japan is on the Allied side and is being occupied by the Germans.
Okay.
Which is kind of implausible, but that's the background. And
yeah.
The whole government of Japan in this timeline. I mean, the biggest indicator that this is an alternate timeline is that all the government military stuff looks very World War II German.
Mm.
Like the iconic symbol of this continuity, because it's like it was a manga, they made a couple other films. There's a Korean remake on Netflix, which I watched before this, where I think the Japanese version is better, that they have like these big mech suits with Stahlhelmen on their heads, and it looks terrifying.
Wow.
But it's awesome.
Mm.
But also terrifying.
Okay.
And like all the armored cars look like World War II German armored cars. And all these little things that you can tell there is this all the history there. Other one is called Rampant. It is a zombie movie set in Joseon Dynasty Korea, which is pretty good.
Right.
It's silly, but it's good.
Mm.
And then there's the sequel to Iron Sky.
Oh, right, okay.
Which I also watched yesterday, and it's on Netflix, at least on American Netflix.
Mm.
And I don't think it's as good as the first one. I think it's interesting. I mean, if I had to pick recent movies that have that sort of feel, Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, Valerian, the City of a Thousand Planets, and also the Guillermo del Toro Hellboy movies, that's what it... And it's like kind of a Lost World thing with like lizard people in the center of the earth.
Yeah.
It's really silly, but it's a lot of fun.
Okay. Well, tremendous stuff. What is your AH pick of the week?
That's a hard one.
Nah.
I'm tempted to say Sergeant Frosty,
because
like honestly, that's just really great, and you should read it.
Yeah.
And it's like, one of the stories in it is like something of a short story collection, is that there's a World War III in the 70s, but it's like this whole deconstruction of like the genre of the World War III thriller, and it gets really meta, and I loved it. And so I think that's quite relevant to this and to the community.
Mm.
I think y'all should read it this holiday season.
Okay. May well do. You never know. All right, my alternate history pick of the week. Well, I have been reading Resurrection Day once again, because sort of refamiliarizing myself with that, because I did read it a little while ago, but yeah, hadn't for a while. I've also been checking out a couple of other bits and pieces online as well. Read something about the well, an interesting alternate history. Not overly sure how realistic it is, really, given the geopolitics at the time, but the idea of the Christmas truce holding and actually becoming permanent in 1914 after everyone was playing that football match.
On the topic of the Christmas truce,
yes,
in the most recent issue of Asimov's science fiction magazine, Harry Turtledove had a short story in which there's the Christmas truce and Hitler's a runner, and then Hitler sees a Christmas truce, gets mad, shoots one of the British officers, and then the officers kill Hitler.
As you do. Yeah.
Which was a funny little story in that in that magazine.
Wow.
So
yeah.
Related.
Yeah. He's a favourite of a lot of AH historians, apart from anything else as well. So there you go. Alex, it has been a pleasure, as always.
It's been a pleasure being on your show, Ben.
And we will be back again. We'll do it again towards the end of next month, towards the end of January. Festive ballistic missiles. That's a new one on me and probably you as well. Many thanks to Alex and, of course, to Colin for talking earlier on about the alternate history of nuclear weapons. And we will be back in 2020 to discuss Brexit. In 1975, that is, and we'll be asking, what if the UK had left the then common market back in 1975 after the referendum? How would the UK have been affected, and what would have happened to other European countries as well? And how will things have played out generally? Much more on all that and more besides next month, when Brexit will probably actually be happening for real at some stage. More on all that and more besides next month on the show. Don't forget, we're available on Facebook for all your feedback, good, bad, and indifferent. We're also available on alternatehistory.com, the Alternate History Timelines website as well, and via Sea Lion Press if you want to get in contact with us that way. Basically, you can't move for seeing us here, there, and everywhere. So, episode 4 to look forward to for January 2020. Make it a New Year's resolution to at least continue listening and downloading, won't you? Have a top Christmas and a very good 2020, and we'll see you on the other side of it.